Hello, I'm Timothy Lim. I'm the professor of Hebrew Bible and Second Temple Judaism at the University of Edinburgh.
Hey everybody, this is David Capes with the Stone Chapel Podcast. If you didn't hear part one of my discussion with Dr. Timothy Lim about the Dead Sea Scrolls, go back and listen to that. It's really important. Give you a context to understand what we're talking about next. In this podcast, we're going to be talking about the shape of the biblical canon. We'll also be talking about a particular style of commentary that's not completely unique, but it's still fairly unique to the Qumran community, called the Peshurim. And then we've got always the nugget of wisdom coming up. So stand by for that. Dr. Timothy Lim. Timothy, great to be with you again on the Stone Chapel Podcast.
Thank you for having me again, David.
Yes, delight to be in your home and delight to be in your city. One of my favorite cities in the world, city of Edinburgh.
You're always welcome.
We got off to a great start before, but one of the things we didn't talk about was the shape of the biblical canon. Mm-hmm. We said a few things about which books were in and which books were not included, but we didn't really talk about the overall.
Yes.
Because when you talk about biblical canon, my understanding is that there are a lot of different canons going on.
Yeah.
What have the Qumran scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls, told us about the shape of the biblical canon?
Yeah, so it's told us like quite a lot of things about the biblical canon in process. So in order to make that clear, let me just give some context and some background. Yeah. First of all, as you say, there are different canons. And that's really, even though we call the Hebrew Bible with a definite noun like that, there are actually different kinds of Old Testament or different Hebrew Bible collections. Some are bigger than others. They share a common core. When we talk about the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, we're often thinking about the Protestant version of the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And that Protestant version of the Old Testament is identical to the Pharisaic canon. The Pharisees had a canon that became the canon of Rabbinic Judaism. So that's exactly the same canon. So that's a context and background. So what the scrolls have done in terms of contributing to this, our understanding, is that the sectarians who were writing did not have a clear concept of canon. Their understanding was much more in process. We've seen the formation of the canon coming through. So we see the edges of that canon, but we don't see the clearly defined one. And what I mean by clearly defined one is a list of all the books that are canon.
Because you couldn't put them in one book, because that would be like one scroll. The length of the average scroll was, what, 28 feet? Something like that?
Something like that.
So beyond that, you really couldn't physically manage it.
Yeah. So the physical aspect of it is one part of it. The 28 feet is an average, because with the Minor Prophet scroll, for example, they're too short. So in fact, that's why they put the Minor Prophets together. Right. They're not minor because they're less important. They're minor because they're shorter. So they come as a 12 prophets altogether, and usually in one scroll. In terms of the canon, what you find in the Dead Sea community among the Essenes is this evolving canon. And that means that they believed in the authoritative status, and I'm saying it very intentionally to say the authoritative status of certain writings, because the canon isn't there yet. So to call it canonical is
right.
A little bit anachronistic, or it's not quite right. The Essenes held to the authoritative status of a number of books that ended up in the canon. In fact, I would say all the books except Esther and the book in the canon.
Right.
But they also held on to different authoritative writings as well. For example, their own rules, their own kind of manuals of discipline, as it were. Mm-hmm. If you think about the church in your own church situation, and you think that, you know, you read scripture as the Old Testament and New Testament, so that is the Bible, that is the authoritative text. But you have also all kinds of things. You could have in, say, the Anglican service, you had their Book of Common Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the
creeds,
kind of thing.
Things like creeds, too.
Creeds, so, absolutely, yeah.
They have a certain authoritative status, don't they?
Exactly. Yeah. So what you have in the Dead Sea Scrolls is what I would describe as two things. One thing, I would describe them as a dual authority. There's a scriptural authority, and there's also their writings that interpret scripture, okay?
That's a part of the commentaries we'll talk about in a minute.
That's right. It's not just scripture in its absolute sense, but it's also the interpretation that gives it authority, and that's the way you need to understand the text.
Well, one of the things I find fascinating is that among the collection is you have multiple copies of certain books.
Yes.
I mean, you don't just have one copy of Isaiah, for example.
Yes, that's right.
You don't Isaiah have just one copy of Psalms, I don't think, right?
Yeah, no. So both those are the most common, and they have numerous copies. In Psalms is almost 40 copies,
really?
If I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Isaiah, there are numerous copies. And the most numerous copies are Isaiah, Psalms, and I think it's Deuteronomy. And it just so happens that they are also the most commonly cited books in the New Testament.
Yeah. So it seems like maybe there's a little bit of connection going on, or a little bit of listening in to each other.
Absolutely.
Their conversations and stuff. Well, let's talk about the Pesherim, because you talked about how the fact that the canon is sort of coming together at this point, and this notion of authority is now being extended.
Yeah.
But not only is the book of Habakkuk, but there's also a commentary on Habakkuk.
That's right.
The book of Nahum and a commentary on Nahum.
That's right.
And those kinds of things. There's one of the things you have just been so clear about is this whole notion of the Pesherim and these particular commentaries. And you're actually the editor for the Oxford Commentary on the Dead Sea Scrolls.
That's right, I am.
And so you're pulling together lots of experts from all over the world, which is a huge blessing and a gift to academics.
And it's a great deal of labor as well.
I can imagine, yeah.
So we have a very good group of scholars working on this Oxford Commentary on the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have 10 volumes planned, and two of them have already been published. The Damascus Document by Stephen Frad of Yale University, and the Pesher Habakkuk that I published. And then there's a third one that is on the way, and that is the volume on the rule of the community and its associated texts. And that's been published by John Collins of Yale University and James Natty, Jesuit School of Theology.
So how did you become editor of this project?
It was my idea.
Okay.
From the very beginning. And I suggested it to OUP, and they thought it was a great idea. And so I thought about the people who would be best placed to write each volume. I gathered a group of eminent scholars as my board of advisors. And we invited, there's no volunteering for the series, right? So for example, the coming volumes, for example, there's one by Carol Newsom, formerly of Emory University, on the Thanksgiving Scroll. There's Temple Scroll by Sidney Crawford.
Each of these are fascinating. We could have a whole podcast about each one of these.
That's right. And we have plans in the future to expand this series. The reason being that when I began this series, I thought, well, I really need to make sure that I don't overextend myself. 10 volumes is quite enough, because I don't want to be one of those editors who create a long list of volumes and never get to them.
Ten volumes.
And I also wanted to see how well they are reviewed. And just so happens that the first two volumes are reviewed very well. That gives us a reason to go on.
Yeah, the documents that you've chosen are some of the most influential, significant. There are other books, as you said.
Yeah.
You don't want to have, for the next 120 years of your life,
you don't want
to have to be busy doing that kind of stuff. Now, you've done a lot of work, and we've used this word Pesherim before, and let's define that for people, because that's not a common word, right?
No,
what is Pesher and Pesherim? What do you mean?
So Pesher is the singular, and Pesherim is the plural. So what it means is literally interpretation. So it's either interpretation or interpretations. Now, what the Pesher terminology does, as it's used in scholarship, it's used as a title for the genre of a particular kind of interpretation of a biblical text. But it is also used as a technique, an exegetical technique. So you have these two uses, the titular one, and also the exegetical or hermeneutical principle one. So in the Pesher is essentially an interpretation. So it follows a particular structure. What it does is it cites a particular passage, and then it follows it with an introductory formula that is an important intellectual spacer that says that from here on in, we're no longer citing scripture, but it's interpretation.
And that word is Pesher.
And that word is quite often Pesher. It's not invariably Pesher.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So often that word comes up, and that's where scholarly construct creates the genre of Pesher. We don't actually have a title that says Pesher. It's that it's a scholarly construct of it. So when we have that particular structure, you have the biblical quotation, which we call the lemma, the introductory formula that introduces the sectarian interpretation, and then the sectarian interpretation. That's the structure.
So that's the literary piece, but that's also, as you said, a technique.
Yes, yes.
As well.
It's a bit like modern commentaries, really. Hmm. If you read a modern commentary, you know, you often get the biblical text repeated to you. Mm-hmm. So that refreshes your mind, and then the interpretation of it, usually the biblical text could be offset by italics or something like that.
But in the interpretive process, what are the sort of guiding principles for Pesher? They're not exactly a modern commentary.
No.
Because a modern commentary would follow a different set of methods to sort of dissect and work with the text.
Yeah.
What are the sort of the methods at work here?
Yeah. So the hermeneutics of Pesher is that they believed in the continuing revelation of God. That's the fundamental principle that guides their interpretation. They believe that the prophecy of Habakkuk, which they believe God revealed to Habakkuk so many years ago, that revelation continues in the way that that revelation is then continued to their community. And that continuation is through the revelation of God to this teacher of righteousness. And that teacher of righteousness then speaks completely, in their mind, completely about the revelation of God. And that revelation is also a revelation about what the prophecy means to their time.
I've often heard it referred to as modernizing the text, bringing it into their modern moment. Is that a good way of thinking about it?
Well, I'm not sure, because modern period really refers to the last few centuries.
Yeah, I guess modernizing it from their standpoint. Taking this ancient text and said what Habakkuk was talking about here actually refers to the wicked priest or the teacher of righteousness.
Right, exactly. Like so in scholarship, it's referred to by two terms. One is contemporizing. Right, so that would be
That's a better word.
Yeah.
Give us an example of one of these texts now. And I know in a minute, if we have time, and I hope we do, we're going to talk about Habakkuk 2:4, which is very important in Paul's writings, but it's also very important here, it seems, in the Pesher of Habakkuk.
So let me read you one. I'm looking at the text itself. And this is to do with Habakkuk 2:4b.
Okay.
So the dilemma or the biblical quotation, but the righteous will live by his faith or faithfulness. And that, for those of you very familiar with Paul's letters, that immediately jumps out at you as something very familiar. So that quotation is then followed by the introductory formula. And the introductory formula says, its interpretation concerns. The word interpretation that is translated there refers to Pesher. So that's the Hebrew word that is being translated into interpretation in that introductory formula. So you now have the dilemma or quotation, the introductory formula, and here comes the sectarian interpretation. It says, so its interpretation concerns all doers of the law in the house of Judah, whom God will deliver from the house of judgment on account of their suffering and their faithfulness in the teacher of righteousness. Hmm. So that's an example of the sectarian interpretation called Pesha.
How does Paul do interpreting it compared to these sectarians?
Very close, I would say, because I think Paul understands it in a way that is both about salvation. Belief in Jesus is salvation from judgment, but also both belief in Jesus and belief in the salvation or deliverance from judgment. Mm. And both those things, as you heard me read,
of those things
is also in the text itself.
Reflected like that.
Within the prophecy of Habakkuk, this Habakkuk 2:4b is actually in the center of the prophecy of Habakkuk. The prophecy of Habakkuk has, in its received form, has three chapters. But in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the interpretation is only of the first two chapters.
Because the third chapter is a separate unit.
Right, with a separate unit with its own title, the Prayer of Habakkuk. So the interpretation is of only of these two chapters. And if you look at this within this first two chapters, the center of that prophecy is Habakkuk 2:1-4. Why? Because they were waiting at the beginning. Habakkuk complains about, proclaims that he sees a vision or a prophecy. And then he complains about theodicy, the wicked, you know, the typical wicked flourishing, the righteous suffering, and why don't you save us type of question. And then he's waiting for the second vision. It's either the second vision or the same vision coming back again. It's not quite clear.
Yeah.
But in any case, that those four verses, Habakkuk 2:1-4, is really the center where it turns. Because from 2:5 onwards, it gives you five different oracles against various wicked people.
So does the New Testament engage in any kind of Pesher-like readings of Scripture?
So in the past, scholars have argued that there are all kinds of Pesher type of interpretation in the New Testament. I think that was in vogue at the beginning.
At one time.
But the kind of understanding that of Pesher is simply a very simple one. For example, Earl Ellis described it simply as X equals Y type of interpretation.
Right.
This is what X is equivalent to what's written in the biblical text, and Y is what how we interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so much more interesting than that.
Yeah, it's more complex than that.
A little more complex than
that. Yeah, yeah. There is this contemporizing of maybe using different methods, but seeing in their own history that God's will is being done.
Yes.
That was pronounced originally in the prophets or originally in some other context, that kind of thing.
In fact, the really interesting thing is that the Pesher Habakkuk also makes hermeneutical statements. And one of the most fascinating ones is that it says that when God revealed it to Habakkuk, he didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. It's only in the fulfillment of time that the teacher of righteousness understands the whole thing. So it's like the prophet was a kind of conduit for divine revelation.
Didn't understand what he was
saying. Didn't understand what he was saying, or maybe didn't understand the full import of it. That would probably be the more accurate one. So the sectarian said, well, our teacher of righteousness knew what it is because there's a following continuous divine revelation, and here it is.
Well, for people who've ever been to the Linear Theological Library, you'll know that we have a facsimile of the Pesher of Habakkuk there.
Ah.
One of seven in the world. They are forgery quality. We, as my lawyer friend Mark Lanier likes to say. We also have the community rule. We also have the great Isaiah scroll
there.
So you can see those and see pretty much what the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves look like if you come. We do have one of four in private hands also, the Dead Sea Scroll jar. a jar from one of the caves that has come out that's been put together.
It's been authenticated.
It's been authenticated. Oh, that's right. Nice. Yeah. So it's a one of four in private hands around the world. So you can come and see all that. But the Dead Sea Scrolls have made a tremendous impact on the way we understand Jews and Judaism at the time of Jesus, but also formation of canon and the bringing together of this new community called the New Covenant Community of Jesus, because this group called itself also, in one of the documents, I don't remember, you know where it is, but the New Covenant Community as well. Mm-hmm. They're people of the New Covenant. But they envisioned that one way, and early Christians viewed that another.
Absolutely.
Dr. Timothy Lamb, we're so grateful for you spending time with us today here on the Stone Chapel Podcast.
Thank you, David.
Hold the phone for a nugget of wisdom from our guest coming up in just a moment. Thanks to Kathy Capes for her expertise in bringing this podcast to you. Thanks to Phil Keggy for our music. If you enjoy the Stone Chapel Podcast, why not stop what you're doing right now and subscribe? Share it with your friends on social media, especially those interested in theology. Come on. You know you want to. Once you do that, it keeps these winsome words coming your way and helps rank us higher on every search engine. If you have questions, comments, or you just want to be in touch, email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. That's podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is spelled L-A-N-I-E-R. Now, until next time, thanks for listening.
So all my life, one of the things that has guided my life in terms of as a biblical scholar is that I focus on the reading of texts, primary sources, the scriptural texts, of course, but also other texts, because I believe that scripture didn't come to us in a vacuum, that we must read other texts. But the other thing is not just to read the text in English translation, but rather to try and study the original languages. So that would be, I would say, my little nugget of wisdom.